While our keynote speaker just suggested that I should introduce him by just saying British General, I didn't think that would do justice to what he brings to the table at this event. We couldn't be more delighted than to welcome Major General Buster Howes. It's not often that we get such a wonderful fit of both timing to speaker and event. For this audience, I don't have to speak to how there is no closer ally to the U.S. than Great Britain, to the extent that they're even willing to go to bad basketball games with our senior leaders. We just are waiting for what will happen to President Obama on his next visit. But the timing of senior leadership visit makes this noteworthy, but also to host Major General Howes for the first time at Brookings. But I think what's even more noteworthy is the discussion we're soon to enjoy, and so appropriate to this gathering of officers and this event, a discussion on lessons learned in leadership, to which General Howes brings an incredible perspective and experience. He was commissioned in the Royal Marines in 1982. Initially, he served as a troop commander in 42 Commando RM, deploying for the first time on operations in Northern Ireland. Subsequent postings and commands include training a recruit troop, mountain leader, appointment to the 2nd U.S. Marine Division as a regimental operations officer during the First Gulf War, Commando Training Wing, 42 Commando RM for the Second Gulf War, 3 Commando Brigade, a planner in UMPROFOR in Bosnia, a strategist in the Naval Staff Directorate, Chief and Joint Coordination Effects for ISAF in Afghanistan, Director Naval Staff, Head of Overseas Operations in MOD, Commandant General Royal Marines, and Command of Operation Atalanta, which is the EU counter-piracy operations for the last 15 months, before currently assuming his position as Head of British Defense Staff USA and Defense Attaché. It's this long, distinguished career and wide range of experiences really does make us all look forward to it, and we very much are thankful for you joining and look forward to your remarks.
Promise and over-deliver. I think I'm riding for a fall after that introduction. It's a great pleasure and privilege to be here today. I am conscious of the US-UK love-in, which has just taken place on our screens. I just was at Andrews Air Force Base seeing the Prime Minister away this morning with Union flags everywhere. So I shall try not to derail this entente cordiale by my remarks. Marine, at least where I come from, is not actually a noun but an acronym for muscles are required, intelligence not essential. So you may not get vast insight from me today, but I will do my best. Peter, when he invited me to come and give some remarks, I said, well, I'll bring some pictures, PowerPoints. And he said, oh, no. And I said, well, I hope they'll add something. Well, there's a good saying that power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts, absolutely, because my PowerPoint done corrupted. So I will, fortunately, I have a sort of another version of this presentation, which I've given in the past. So forgive me if what I'm trying to say and the images are a bit incoherent, and I will sort of muddle through and use them where relevant, but you may have to bear with me a little bit. We've got 40 minutes, I think, and I'll try and leave a good 10 minutes at the end for questions. We all know what good looks like, and this man's image will be better known to you than it is to me, and the 20th of Maine at Little Round Top at Gettysburg. In that crisis, I ordered the bayonet. The word was enough. The knightliest of knights, a man who was wounded 6 times and took part in 20 battles. A man who spoke English, Greek, Latin, Spanish, German, French, Italian, Arabic, Hebrew, and Syrianic fluently. And we can recognize when things go wrong, what bad looks like. This is Baba Musa, a young 26-year-old receptionist who on the 14th of September 2003 was taken into custody by the Queen's Lancashire Regiment in Iraq after the Battle of Danny Boy. 2 days later, he was dead in custody, having sustained 93 different traumas. There are 230,000 Google sites which appear if you put Baja Musa into a search engine. Kennedy said of Churchill that he was a man who mobilized the English language and led it into battle. There is more written about leadership than almost any other subject, but it doesn't tend to get one much closer to the essence of it. I wanted to talk a little bit about leadership in an ethical context. And ethics is a set of moral principles from ethos, the Greek. Morals, the study of right and wrong, the coda by which good and bad is judged in human behaviour. Too often, though, in operations, we have to judge between wrong and wrong. We make very, very difficult, time-sensitive decisions with inadequate information where you make a judgment between A and B, and somewhere down the pipe, maybe just a matter of minutes, sometimes a matter of months, because you chose B in that first binary judgment, you end up with a decision between X and Y, and you have no choice but to make Y. So the linkage between those decisions, the whole imperative of thinking to the finish and being able to conceptualise the third, fourth and fifth order implications of what you do are pretty key. Now, when Peter and I talked about what I might speak about today, I was slightly ambivalent about whether this subject would sit comfortably within the other topics you've discussed. And I suspect that, you know, understanding or speaking about the implications of British defence policy or European defence policy would have been more in the vein of some of the other narratives. But I have been struck in the last couple of weeks, months, January, February, and more recently, and I made no comment whatsoever about the context of it because it is clearly sub judice. But as a piece of context, and I don't have this slide, George Packer, News from the Wars, New Yorker, 13th of March 2012. The massacre in Afghanistan is making a lot of people write history today. It is the sort of incident that immediately symbolises extreme violence and futility and the inevitable end of a war effort. It's already in the books. After this, it's impossible to imagine any kind of honourable and satisfactory conclusion to the decade of American involvement in Afghanistan. We already know that the Panjwai killings will have a prominent place in the accounts of the Afghan war, like My Lai in South Vietnam and Abu Ghraib and Haditha in Iraq. And just as those atrocities stained everyone who had anything to do with those wars, Panjwai will be a blight on every soldier and civilian and policymaker who left any fingerprints on the Afghan war, no matter how good their intentions, no matter how hard they tried to make it come out right. You could construe those as rather histrionic words, and time will tell, journalism being the first rough draft of history and all of that. But the point, nevertheless, I think, has a grain of truth in it. In campaign analysis, we always try and look for the campaign fulcrum, good or bad. It's a very hard thing to deduce. You know, it's obviously there's a bit of magic dust about it, and very often you can only see it retrospectively. And this may or may not be. But it will have, at a time when the narrative, when the public perception is very finely poised, this and other acts like it, however they take place, are important. The sort of toxic strategy to task linkage. We talk about the strategic corporal. But good and bad, so often that is an absolutely brilliant thing. The ability of boys and girls to make their own judgments and to do brave, courageous, complex, difficult things with a minimum of direction. But when the train runs off the rails, the obverse applies. And if you just take imagery on its own, it's quite interesting to think about the images. And this is not about America. I contextualise that very carefully. I start off with a very difficult example for my own nation. There are examples of coalition actors in the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years from every country. We all have this challenge. And you could say, well, there's nothing you can do about it. The fact is that shit happens and it'll happen. But it seems to me that the strategic impact on campaigns of these sort of occurrences, demand that leaders bear down and think and think and think on this issue. Because if you can reduce the incidence, however small, by 15%, you're having a major bearing on your campaigns. So, very briefly, and I'm watching the clock, and I am going to run out of time, the why, the way, and the whence. Why is it important? I've probably given you an insight on that. How one might go about breeding leaders, training, educating people, and then where does the sort of intestinal fortitude, the energy, insight, persistence, and stamina come from? In the past, we've tended to focus in a rather sterile manner when we've covered ethics, with men and women quite often at staff colleges, middle seniority individuals, and we persist on teaching them Augustinian theory, jus ad bellum, jus in bello, when actually they know the difference between right and wrong. I mean, they wouldn't be majors, and commanders and colonels if they didn't. And we don't get beyond that. And for too long in Britain, we sort of fixated on a theoretical conversation which really assisted nobody. There was a great quote by William Johnson. What is a great school for? You are not engaged so much in acquiring knowledge as in making mental efforts under criticism. A certain amount of knowledge you can, with average faculties, acquire. But you go to a great school not so much for knowledge as for arts and habits, the habit of attention, for the art of expression, for the art of assuming at a moment's notice a new intellectual position, for the art of entering quickly into another person's thoughts, for the habit of submitting to censure and refutation, for the art of indicating assent and dissent in graduated terms, for the habit of regarding minute points of accuracy, for the art of working out what is possible in a given time, for taste, for discrimination, for mental courage and mental soberness. And above all, you go to a great school for self-knowledge. And when you are working in a complex, shifting, difficult, ambiguous moral environment, self-knowledge is quite close to being the key. If you haven't spent the time to think and examine and ruminate, to work out who you are and what you stand for, when you're really, really under pressure, don't be surprised if your references are blurred. So this tends to be the dialect, and it's not a useful one. So why? Well, uncertainty absolutely continues to characterize what we do. This is a quote from the Second World War, but it still applies. During 2003, when I was with the United States, 2003, when I was part of the second MEF, we attacked into southern Iraq at the start of the Gulf War. These were the assets, the intelligence assets, which were looking at a piece of ground which was not particularly large, which was as flat as a billiard table. 3 days after we had attacked, we then had to secure a small settlement, Umm Qayyal, because it controlled the water supply to Basra, and they were very worried about cholera and a serious illness. And we had to do it fast. And we were told that it was a concrete facility. There were no maps. There were no air photographs of this. So I sent some people in, and they drew this map on the wall, having spent 36 hours recceing the location. There were 37,000 people living around this facility. We did a combined arms assault at battalion minus level to break in order to seize this facility. Uncertainty still applies. You all know Krulak's quotation. I'm not going to labour that. And our conception of war is this, because this is a kind of known quantity. War is a very, very difficult thing to depict, and we tend to get our imagery from films, because it's a mess and a muddle, and it's an empty battlefield, and nothing goes on most of the time. So trying to get the right images, real images, is almost impossible. But that is actually the reality now. A complex, congested, cluttered, contested, connected and constrained environment. Rupert Smith's War Amongst the People. The other challenge, this was a recruiting poster when I joined the Royal Marines, and this came out in 1986. And the inference was that the Royal Marines have been involved in operations every year, in fact, since the start of the Second World War, and have lost men who have fought and died against the Queen's enemies since that time, except in 1968, when apparently we sat on a beach with a young lady in a bikini with a ridiculous hat. In 1968, the Royal Marines took a holiday. And when I joined 42 Commando, we then went straight off to Iraq. And my ops officer, John Bailey, said, "There are two speeds in this unit, boss, flat out and stop. And stop is Christmas Day." So you have that challenge. This isn't going to run, which is a pity. Have you seen this video before? Okay, this guy is sitting on the top of an elephant. And he's sitting there, and you're sitting there on the back of the elephant with him. And you're looking at the pampas grass, and you have no idea what the context is. And a tiger comes out of the grass like a missile. Look it up on Google it. And it comes shooting out of the grass somewhere in the middle of this thing and comes right at him with its mouth open about a yard. And there's a metaphor for the challenges that strike you in complex environments. It's a good one. Because they blindside you and sometimes have absolutely no preamble. And if you've got a bamboo cane in your hand, top tip, you need to have thought a little bit about what you're going to do with the bamboo cane before the tiger's coming at you, because it's a bit late. So this is the environment. This is the environment, and I've talked a lot around the world and to staff colleges about catalysing that interest in thinking about these issues. You know, when you're hanging on by your fingertips, it doesn't do to wave your arms around. So if you've got the baton and you're the conductor, you kind of need to rehearse a bit. And what I sometimes do, I don't know if the slide's here because I'm using it, yeah, it is here, but the sound isn't, so you're lucky. What I usually do is I walk into the audience and I give... It's not going to run either. This is about Zach and inside Zach's helmet, and it's about a young man who has this bung of paper inside his helmet, like a Bible, and the notion that you have to think before you're in contact. Every time the army wants you to know something, they give you a piece of paper, and you put it inside your helmet. And his last point is, but I've yet to meet anybody who, when in action and in contact, takes off their goddamn helmet to find out what they're supposed to do next. So it's a variation on the theme. As a leader, when things go wrong, time slows down. And, you know, anger in the voice is kind of the death rattle of reason. And in the few instances where I have been at the point of decision directly in a tactical environment where people are dying around me, it's a sort of crystallizing thing, and I suspect a lot of you have been in a similar situation where suddenly everybody is looking at you. And the tendency over time, if you're involved in managing things where there is a time dimension to it, is to become risk averse. When I was a young platoon commander, I wasn't a very good map reader. I just wasn't. It's something you learn through experience. And so I used to always put my best map reader to lead the platoon. And so the guys who, like me, weren't as good as they should have been never got the chance to learn, because I didn't want to get lost, because I knew my company commander would be pissed off with me. For the common soldier, at least, war has the feel, the spiritual texture of a ghostly fog. There is no clarity, everything. The old rules are no longer binding. The old truths no longer true. That's perhaps a more up-to-date one. So why? You'll be well familiar with this. This happens to be an American example, 1968, William Kelly. I put this up because I'm going to put an English and British example up in a minute. When Charlie Company went into My Lai in 1968, they had been in Vietnam for 3 months. They had been launched on an operation where they were expecting to meet the enemy symmetrically, if you like, and he didn't deign to do so. And several of their company were wounded and injured whilst they were patrolling, and they couldn't respond. It was a hidden enemy. He never shaped up. It was like clutching smoke. And their inability to control their environment built up inside them. William Calley was 24. He was of below average intellect. He was short, unpopular, unfit, nervous, excitable, and too gung-ho. He was always trying to impress his superiors, but his company commander, Mendina, used to ridicule him in public in front of his troops. The average age of those in his company was 20. Hugh Thompson, who was the helicopter pilot, was the only man in the entire sort of undertaking who managed to, in the confusion, maintain his moral compass. Oz Schmidt here on the left was a British bomb disposal expert who, after his third tour in Afghanistan, was blown up and killed. And the IED threat in Afghanistan, in Iraq, which surely will be a model of things for the future, if the entire NATO forces in Iraq, in Afghanistan, can be bogged down by men with using fertilizer and very simple triggering devices in an urban environment to such spectacular effect, we have to assume that this will be at least part of the war of the future. And this inability of soldiers to control a threat which they can't see and which is incredibly difficult to respond to applies massive psychological pressures on them. Herrick 10 was, we call each rotation of soldiers in Afghanistan a Herrick. So Herrick 10, this was one, had an unparalleled IED threat. Across the task force area of operations, there is an IED explosion every 16 patrols. And in Sangin, which you will now be well familiar with because the United States Marine Corps did a relief in place with us, one in six patrols will suffer an IED casualty. So you're patrolling between 1 and 9 times a day for 6 months, and you have a 1 in 6 chance of being blown up by something you can't see and can only really respond to. So there are some examples. Deep Cut was a training establishment in Britain, so it doesn't always happen on operations. Rwanda, Romeo Dallaire's book, Srebrenica, which was a classic example of first decision. You know, Thomas Karimans, a Dutchman, squaring up to Ratko Mladic. 9,000 young men were put to the sword, the largest massacre in Europe since the Second World War. You know, was it just Karimans? No, of course it wasn't. There's a whole systemic aspect to what transpired. This was Dachau. I won't go into this example now, but it's a very instructive one. US forces coming across Dachau, having fought their way through Europe, appalled by what they saw, summarily executed all the guards, which seems to be actually quite a reasonable judgment, and Patton supported and destroyed all the evidence. But the guards weren't the guards, and the blokes who'd done it had all disappeared, and when they were subsequently rounded up, they were all exonerated because of this judgment. Let me go back to that one. This is a bit of analysis I did some years ago as to why things went wrong and why discipline breaks down. And it makes no allowance for sort of mental state. But if you take these ellipses and you take the outer one as the way you would wish your people to be, in other words, a disciplined, happy, well-led, well-motivated group of people, and then the centre one as being something which has gone badly wrong, either collectively, and this was through the prism of the First World War and 92 French divisions mutinying in the trenches after the Nivelle Offensive. And you take the arrows as causal factors. One of the biggest ones is loss of faith in or failure of command and leadership. Sometimes there are weird things, you know, specific catalysts or tipping point which can take you from good to terrible in a very short space of time. But some of those you will recognise. Fear is an obvious one. Compromised locus of control, exhaustion, lack of dialogue with authorities, lack of support to or from family or from nation, unjust cause. There are things to be considered.
So I want to touch on this business. So what about the leadership bit? Well, back into what you think about. And asking some quite difficult questions. How am I doing for time? Another five? Bob Geldof is probably a slightly odd example to quote, but as a man who kind of tells it as it is and stands up for what he believes, what do you stand for? When one asks these questions, people sort of get restive, and because particularly a British audience, because we're terribly buttoned up and stiff upper lipped, and we don't do emotion in public, and you'll get army officers all starting to wriggle in their seats and sort of examine their boots. Aung San Suu Kyi, what will you fight for? And there was a huge debate going on during the Bosnian crisis of people were much more prepared to fight than to die. So what would you die for? And this is, you can look at this existentially. I mean, very, very few people go to war anticipating that for the Afghan cause or for protecting hearth and home. I think part of this process of discovery is about having multiple lenses. When you're trying to do complex problem solving as a leader, you know, we have this notion of tag team. You know, you bring a lot of people in to examine something. And you're back, if you like, full circle to Joshua Chamberlain and why he was such a visionary and brilliant man. It was because he had that ability to look around and beyond and sideways and could see the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, probably in Greek, or in Sanskrit, solution to the problem he was examining. And he had the moral authority and the confidence to be a bit alternative. And one of the criticisms of all education, particularly education in Britain, but military education, is we stuff it so full of things that we think are mainstream. You know, when you go to university to read history in Britain, at the age of 19, you'll get two lectures a week. And at the end of 3 years, you have to go to pass a moderately rigorous set of exams to get your degree. At the age of 37, 38, you go to staff college, and every single waking hour is scheduled, because you can't be trusted to take time off and do your own study. So how often do you get to depart from the mainstream of what the military has decided is important for you to learn? How do I get rid of that? Not often. Okay, we're fully frozen now. Okay, I'm going to wind up. And this has been a horribly incoherent presentation, I fear. A couple of very quick points. To lead in difficult circumstances, you know, the business of being sort of interesting and interested, trust, which is the fundament of all this, could be described as an equation, which is credibility plus reliability plus intimacy. And the credibility bit is you can do what you say you'll do. So you're a professional. You are expert in your role. Reliability is you do what you say you'll do. So you deliver. Intimacy is being accessible. It is being understood. It is engaging. It is being prepared to take risks and to look foolish and not to guard your reputation as the most important thing that you have as you get older and more senior and bolder and more like a caricature of a general. And all this is divided by perceptions of self-interest. And when you engage with people to understand those who are struggling, you may have issues within your midst so that you can mitigate the risks of individual people doing incredibly damaging things. You genuinely have to engage. Definition of a bore is a man, when you ask him how he is, tells you, how are you?
Very well.
Very well. I've walked around this entire room, I've been engaging in a company of men for 3 years, shaking their hands and asking them how they are, and they're self-evident that they're very well. Your whole life could be put in the heart of pain. You could have left today with absolute disaster when you came, and you'd still tell me things were. I broke my pelvis 3 years ago in a ridiculous accident and flatlined twice, and eventually I came back to work. And I caught myself doing exactly the same thing. How are you? I'm absolutely fine. Took me... By that stage, I was walking again, because otherwise they'd have had a queue. I'd have been in a wheelchair. But getting beyond that, and the Byrne model, you get beyond ritual and cliche, facts and information, opinions and judgment, beliefs and values, to emotions and rapport. And at that point, you get engagement. And at that point, you get behavioural shift. So if you've thought through what you stand for and how you are, the only chance you then have of really communicating in the way that Chamberlain did is if you get beyond that. Now, it's complex. There are 18 ranks between me and a private infantryman in the Royal Marines. So you've got to, you know, it's about personal power, not positional power. So you have to take the badge off. But then he's sort of sitting there looking at you thinking, you look very old for a private soldier. And you sit there and you try and find a really informal environment. And I have to say, your senior officers are brilliant at it. It comes from your traditions of a citizen soldiery, the Minutemen, the fact that there is a contract. And you call it, you're very respectful, and you listen well. Things that military people aren't great at. You issue with two ears and one mouth, and the trick is to use them in that ratio. but that, you know, that business of engagement, not dominating in conversation, and allowing people to express themselves so you understand, is a very complex and extremely sophisticated thing. I guess the last point I'd make is that if you write something down, you have a 70% better chance of doing it. It's part of a sort of neuro-linguistic programming thing. So I would invite all of you as practitioners, and I don't know whether anything I've said has touched a chord in its rather, I'm afraid, pickledy way. Get hold of a piece of A4, I don't know what you call it in America, a big bit of paper that you can fold in your pocket. And write down, find some model which starts to explicitly bound what it is you stand for and how you are, particularly under pressure. What are the things you're bad at? What are the things you're good at? What are the things you want to be better at? From a really holistic sort of perspective. And if you can then put this into, you know, a good vision statement. Martin Luther King said a vision is a target that beckons. And it should be realizable, imaginable. You should be able to pitch it quickly. And you can use that as a contract, and I've used it a lot working in dynamic headquarters. When I was charging around chasing pirates in the Indian Ocean, I had 27 nations working for me. They did an average trawl length of 4 months, and there were 137 people. It was really hard to keep track of them. So every so often, I'd come bouncing back into the headquarters and say, hello, you, this is me. And I would put this thing up, and it would explicitly say not what I am, but at least what I aspired to be, so that Spanish officer whose cultural background is completely different to me, who may be very, very deferential and frightened of, you know, a bloke who's 18 ranks above him, goes, okay, well, this guy's not all that bothered about that. And then he says, you know, surprise is the pith and marrow of war, and the leader is a dealer in hope, and. And you have now explicitly said who you are. And if you lose your temper when you say that actually calmness in the face of adversity is key, you can say, well, hang on a minute. You haven't lived up to your part of the deal. And he's right. Transmission ends. How are we for time?
We've got about 15 minutes.
Okay.
I would urge you to add one more slide to the presentation. Right after, what would you die for? What would you kill for? There's sort of a... in the human race, a common list of things we would kill for, to defend our families or whatnot. But when you go beyond the common list, when you're willing to kill for your party, your bath party, your communist party, your scripture, your cartoons of your prophet, those define the national security threats. So equally important to what would you die for is what would you kill for, because those are going to define the horizons and the frontiers at which you're going to be fighting.
Stanley Kober, what makes an order legal or illegal? What would, in an order, incline you to disobey the order as illegal?
Well, I could give you, that's a very difficult question. I could give you, you know, the legitimacy, proportionality. I mean, there are, you can go back into Augustinian philosophy, which is basically underpins military law. I mean, there's a bit which says this is a lawful order. And if you go into them, but that doesn't really help you. You're back to inside Zach's helmet, aren't you? Yeah, the moment where you're given an order, you somehow can't hear me.
Can you hear me now? At the moment, you know, you're given that order, you know, what do you do? I mean, a lot of it comes back down to the fact that have you thought about this and does it feel right? But not doing it or finding a different way. I mean, is it a question of action or inaction? Probably not, because there are lots of options. You know, if you were sitting on a road and there are people around you being killed by sniper fire, and every 2 seconds another man is shot because you're hiding behind a stone curb which is 6 inches high, and they're all around you in the buildings, and you have the option of bringing an airstrike in on those buildings. You could drop Fay on it. You could drop something really chunky in and you can neutralise the problem. But you know that there are, I don't know, 5 snipers, but all the buildings are occupied by, you know, families. What do you do? Is that legal or lawful or unlawful? You will have options. And I don't think, I mean, you're probably right when it boils down to judgments. I mean, I think in a way it's more interesting to examine it not from the point of view of the order, but more from the judgment. Because very often people aren't acting with orders. The most difficult thing, they have, you know, overall intent. And the most difficult thing is that, you know, when the undertaking starts, that slide I put up of the helicopter assault, we had an 89-page operations order with very, very detailed synchronization and all the rest of it. It was the largest helicopter assault in Vietnam. And 11 minutes into that, a helicopter crashed and 12 men were dead. 4 US Marines, 8 Royal Marines. And the whole thing was then re-cocked in short notice. I think it was Eisner who said that, counterintuitively, the important thing is not the plan, but the planning. And the collective intuition which grows from that undertaking. So, and then when the thing is running, it's kind of running. So that, you know, in the contested, connected, congested, constrained, blah environment, once the, you know, you set people off and tell them to go forth and do what it is you're trying to achieve, and then they kind of make their judgments in the moment, and particularly in an urban environment, which brings you full circle back to education. Because at the end of the day, it's the individual who judges, not somebody like me who by sort of fiat and, you know, complex machinery says, this is what you should do. And he then looks all the way back up the chain and says, that's unlawful, I'm not doing it. Ma'am. Yes. Oh, you want a
mic? I was just wondering if you believe... Thank you. Clara O'Donnell, visiting fellow at Brookings. I was just wondering if the challenges that you've raised regarding leading troops, if you believe that they become more complex when one is trying to lead troops from various countries together. And as part of that answer, I was wondering, to what extent do you think that the British and French armed forces might encounter challenges from a cultural level as they try to work increasingly closely together?
She's English. Did you understand that? It was about... Did you get that? Did you get her question? I think I got her question. It was about the extra level of complexity of coalition forces when the troops who are cooperating have different... cultures. English and French, thank you for sharpening me up on the specifics. I'll come back to the specifics. I mean, I think, let me just, we're all prisoners of our experience. Bosnia was an interesting experience in that the Secretary General of the United Nations at the time was an Egyptian Copt, Boutros Ghali, and his special advisor, Yukushi Akashi, was Japanese. So they're two quite interesting layers, both very bright men. So they had certain cultural lens, and then they were looking into a mélange of sort of ethnic, cultural, tribal tensions within Bosnia-Herzegovina. And a whole raft of different nations all trying to come to a conclusion and to find the moral courage to do some difficult things, which were quite a step change from what we'd done before that, and Europe lacking leadership to sort of grasp the nettle. And the prism that you were trying to see this through was so, had so many moats in it, so many flaws, that I'm sure that compounded the problem. To come back to the specifics of what you said, so it adds to the challenge, undoubtedly. You know, it's, there's a sort of whole veneer of potential distortion, is what I'm saying to you, what you're hearing. We both come from the same country, but you're a woman and I'm a man, and I'm about twice your age, and. But all things being equal, you're understanding me better than the ladies and gentlemen from America, just because we're British, perhaps. As far as the, I can quote the Prime Minister yesterday, who at lunch with, I happened to be at lunch with the Secretary of State in the State Department, and he said, it was about 1812. Everywhere we went, we bumped into 1812. Usually humorously-ish. And I was thinking, that's actually not that long ago, really. It isn't, is it? And it's not three generations if you measure a generation by 10 years, but it's three lots of 70-year-old men who burnt the White House down. And he was asked about why the British weren't making more of 1812, and the real reason is because we're sort of running around doing the Olympics, and we have the Queen's got the Diamond Jubilee, so those are the two things we're doing this year. And actually, we'd rather celebrate the start of a friendship rather than beginning of a war, so 1815. But Prime Minister Cameron gave a different reason. He said, well, we're coming up to the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo when we stuffed the French, and we'd much rather celebrate that. So I got slightly higher level coverage on that. I mean, a sensible, serious answer, globalisation, I guess, helps. There's cultural convergence all over. But at the end of the day, it boils down to national interest, doesn't it? You know, if we are cooperating and have coincident, clear interest, then we'll find a way to accommodate and compromise and work well together. And where we don't, we won't. I'm not sure I've answered your question very well.
Just one last question.
Oh, the gentleman right at the back.
Thank you.
Since I have a microphone.
Sir, I had a question about the seeing the elephant, which I think was a phrase in the American Civil War. You'd either seen the elephant or you hadn't. Maybe it's seeing the tiger and the jumping out at you. Just from listening to you and as a veteran, it sounds like you know what you're talking about. So do you have any advice for policymakers or those of us in the room that maybe don't have the same visceral experience as you, especially making decisions that send people to make life-altering decisions?
I guess I would return to the rather busy diagram I put together when I was at Staff College some years ago, that bullseye thing. You know, this is a complex, multifactorial issue. And the buttons that you press with people, they're non-linear. They're not necessarily predictable. And they're not like steel. You take a piece of steel and you can stress it to failure in a predictable manner. In an engineering context, you can, you know, all things being equal, the piece of steel will fail at the same point each time. People aren't like that. And when policy decisions are made, particularly in the way that people's lives are managed, and this takes in the sort of holistic bit, there's a great generosity of spirit amongst the American people in the way that the military is looked after. I had the huge privilege of meeting your commander-in-chief yesterday, the president in the White House. And I stuck my hand out, and he looked at me and he said, thank you for your service.
which I understand is quite a standard salutation for servicemen in dress. But I wasn't expecting it from him. So I looked at him back and said, well, thank you for yours. And I don't know whether he thought I was being rude or otherwise. I hope not, because it was meant. So for policymakers, I think it's the recognition that when you make judgments, particularly in times of austerity, you decide to trim something, you adjust something, you always have to keep a very careful eye on the fact that what you're doing in terms of goodwill, support, the downstream implication of something which seems actually quite logical and trivial, whether it's in a operational context or whether it's in a supporting the family context, can have very, very uncertain consequences. So you're back to understanding the sophistication of what makes people tick, and it's not always obvious. And you can push people, and then just doing the analysis, you know, understanding what tour length does, doing the rigorous assessment on the, taking the trouble on the basis of the very significant amount of experience we have, regrettably, in the last decade and a half, to really try to understand what affects what, so that, you know, one can reduce the 1%, 0.1%, 0.001% chance of people acting in a way that you, all of us would rather they didn't, to something less than that.
Well, before I introduced the general, he asked me not to oversell him. And I think you can see that I definitely did not oversell him. I undersold the remarks. You can see how rapt this audience is. We want to thank you again, so please join me in the audience. Come on up and join us here.
How do I get this out?
Gerald, thanks so much. That was really. What's in your A4 piece of paper? What's on it?
I've got a copy of it somewhere. I'm not sure if I've got it here, but if I have, would you, tell you what, if you write down your, I might have it here. We're about to do a Q&A.
Yeah.
Could you get, yes, brilliant. Can you give me the other disc as well, even though it's corrupted?
Right.
Did you? Brilliant. And can you delete that for me off the? Thank you, because it's got pictures of my kids and things.
There's my non-Brookings card.
Can you say that, but it appears in your Brookings card. It's made it happen. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm just curious.
Hey guys, if I can ask you to take your seats. I used to be a musician, and we always knew the worst slot of the night was right after the star attraction. And I feel
so
like,
you know, that's
happening
to speak
right now.
Mute.
I thought that was a really remarkable presentation by the general. You know, we've covered a lot of big topics today. U.S.'s future relationship with China. The nature of ethics in wartime, the future of our NATO alliances. So luckily we've got, this panel's about some really small, minor topics, like the future of the Afghan war, decision-making going forward in any future combat operations, the capability of al-Qaeda and every other terrorist group, and whether they're ever going to acquire weapons of mass destruction. So pretty small topics. I figured the whole panel should take, like, what do you think, guys, like 3-4 minutes tops, and then we can get out of here. Okay, that joke went over well. my name's Noah Shackman. I'm a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, and here to sort through those issues. We've got a great panel. We've got, starting to my immediate left, Lieutenant Colonel Crystal Murphy, who's an Air Force fellow at Argonne National Laboratory. She's an Air Force bioenvironmental engineer, and as part of that mission, she's deployed in support of both Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. She's also served at U.S. Strategic Command's Center for Combating Weapons of Mass Destruction. To her left is Colonel Eric Gopner. Am I pronouncing that right? Good. He's a military fellow at CSIS. He is an Air Force Security Forces officer with 18 years experience. In 2010, he commanded a provincial reconstruction team in Zabul, Afghanistan, very unusually for an Air Force officer, and led a squadron in 2007 responsible for detention operations at Camp Buka in Iraq. And finally, at the end of the table, we've got Randy Blake, federal executive fellow here at the Brookings Institution. He's got 25 years of experience in the intelligence community, and most recently served at the National Counterterrorism Center. Before that, he served in leadership positions at the Defense Intelligence Agency and at U.S. European Command. So I'd like to ask Colonel Gopner to start out, who's got a very interesting presentation, I think, on Afghanistan. And then we'll go to Randy and then to Crystal, and they'll make present for about 10 minutes each, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Good afternoon, everybody. So this all started back in 2009 as we were preparing to go to Zabul in southern Afghanistan. The research, the midway point, was battered spouse syndrome, which you may be seeing in your handout today. And we're just going to kind of do a little tactical deception roll right by that. And I want to start off with giving you a non-controversial proposition. And it's basically this idea that there is an enduring argument against counterinsurgency. And the enduring argument has essentially nothing to do with today's budgetary woes, and it has nothing to do with wary eyes towards China or the pivot that we're doing currently. The argument is that successfully countering insurgency in weak and failed states, which is where we typically have conducted COIN, it's where we are more than likely to continue conducting COIN in the future, is an almost impossible venture. That's my premise. This difficulty is driven in part by the high rate of mental disorders that are common to the populations of weak and failed states. Said another way, the main effort in COIN is the host nation government and the host nation security force and the population whose allegiance they're seeking. Both those groups are beset by high rates of mental disorder, is what I'm going to seek to sort of establish for your consideration today. Just as mental disorders have a deleterious effect on the individual level, once a population has enough, a high enough rate of mental disorder, it's going to have a similarly deleterious effect on the society writ large. And central to my argument is that a nexus exists between weak and failed states, insurgencies, and the prevalence of mental disorders. And so just quick background on weak and failed states. Back in 1994, kind of the study began in earnest. Political Instability Task Force, funded, interestingly enough, by the CIA. That work is continued today by the Fund for Peace, by Foreign Policy Magazine, George Mason University, and now the Center for Systemic Peace, who kind of keeps the broadest set of data. Their data goes back to 1995. And what they're looking at is a broad array of security, political, economic, and social factors that speak to a government's legitimacy and a government's effectiveness. And what they do is they essentially give you a grade of all the nations, and they put you in one of six categories. The easiest or best category, if you will, are those states with little to no fragility, which would be the United States plus an additional 41 states currently. You slide all the way down to sort of the butt end of weak and failed states, those that are extremely fragile. There are eight currently in that category. Afghanistan would be one, Chad, Somalia, that type of thing. So my first point is that insurgencies tend to take place in weak and failed states. So there's 8 states currently listed as extremely fragile. 7 of those 8 are at war. If you do a study back over the last 10 years, of all extremely fragile states, they were at war 64% of the time. If you go to the second category, kind of the fifth worst category, they were only at war 15% of the time, and you keep stepping down until you get to countries like us at low to no fragility, and they're only at war 2% of the time. The 2009 authors concluded their report by saying, if you're a weak and failed state, that is synonymous with nearly perpetual warfare, if that makes sense to you. And then at the regional level, that was kind of affirmed by Ndulu et al. They did a study of 25 years in Africa, 1970, 1995, and they found that failed states were at war 60% of the time. And then they did it in the reverse, and they found that of all wars that had taken place in Africa in that 2.5 decades, 70% took place in weak and failed states. So the idea is the majority of insurgencies do occur in weak and failed state, and then kind of the dull light is if we're going to do coin in the future, we're bound to do it in weak and failed states. So my second point, and potentially what's more provocative, is this idea that weak and failed states are home to really high rates of mental disorder. And I'm way out of my league here in terms of as a security law enforcement guy, but I read some really good articles. The mental disorders that I want to kind of focus on are post-traumatic stress disorder and major depressive disorder, and I'll refer to them just as PTSD and depression, but when I do, I'm trying to fall in line with the American Psychiatric Association's definition, and you can check it out in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. So just like the military, they do a great job of codifying everything, and so you can kind of check out the way they define those things. Quick caveat, if you have PTSD or you have depression, those are considered highly what they call comorbid mental disorders. If you have one of them, the chances you're going to have another mental disorder as well. For those who have PTSD, 30 to 50% of you will end up having major depressive disorder as well. So you get the idea of if you have one, you can oftentimes have the other. In terms of causation, there is some debate, but generally PTSD and depression are caused by exposure to traumatic events. They'll usually refer to 3 factors, the severity of the trauma, the cumulative nature of the trauma, and then how long since the last traumatic exposure until today. And those are the 3 variables they usually look at. For PTSD, the number one driver of whether you will or won't get it is the severity of trauma. For men, it's typically combat. For women, it's typically rape. When you go to depression, it's the cumulative trauma that tends to be the primary driver. So you look at APA and a number of different peer-reviewed articles, and you'll come away with the idea that about 5% of the world's population currently has PTSD. The Journal of the American Medical Association did a great meta-analysis where they take 181 studies of PTSD and or depression, and basically, they take all the disparate numbers and they give you a sense of what the literature suggests the rates are today. So for PTSD in a weak and failed state, 30.6% tend to have PTSD. Depression rates almost identical, 30.8%. So you go from 5% up to 30.6% PTSD rate in a weak and failed state. And then they went another step, and they said, okay, let's look at those weak and failed states that also have high, what they call terror rates. And there's really cool work being done by the University of North Carolina. Data goes all the way back to 1976, called the Political Terror Scale. And basically they said when you get to a certain level of political terror, your PTSD rate jumps from 30.6% to 53.4% of the population. You may want to place a wager on the likelihood that Afghanistan or Iraq has been on that list much. Iraq since 1983 without exception. Afghanistan began the list in 1979, came off the list twice, once in 1990, once in 2003. So the medical experts in their peer-reviewed journals suggest to us that more than 1 in 2 Iraqis, more than 1 in 2 Afghans has PTSD today. You know, medically diagnosed, if they were able to see a doctor, PTSD. The impact of mental disorder is kind of like a no-brainer. As a military guy, if I have enough men and women in my unit with PTSD, we're declared combat ineffective. If I'm overseeing an office where everybody has depression, I don't expect a lot of ingenuity, a lot of effort, a lot of self-starting. Job performance is going to suffer. That's kind of just a layperson's assumption. The APA does it a little more precisely, and they say if you've got PTSD or major depressive disorder, you have an array of cognitive and behavioral symptoms that impair your social, occupational, or other area of functioning. Large body of literature also suggests if you have either of those, you also have impaired learning and memory processes as well. Potentially, though, the most difficult piece is something called learned helplessness. And if anybody's interested, it's a really great body of work that began in the 70s. Martin Seligman kind of spearheaded that effort. And it's back when we weren't limited in how we treated animals. So they did some really crazy stuff to dogs, and then they did less crazy stuff to human beings. And what they found out is you can teach people by experience to be helpless. And the idea is that after you have enough exposure to uncontrollable events, the person no longer perceives themselves as having control over future outcomes, so they no longer give an effort. Their learning is impaired, voluntary initiation of activity decreases, and their interest levels decrease. And so having spent a good amount of time in Zabul province, southern Afghanistan, that for me was the number one piece that resonated. That was the group of people I saw. It was a group of people that had learned how to become helpless. They could tell you every problem ad nauseum, and then when you'd start to war game and what if on how to solve them, every answer was, it's impossible, it's impossible, it's impossible. Remission, which is kind of the medical term for curing somebody for depression, remission rates are not positive at all. The meta-analysis that looked at 34 cases or 34 studies of depression found that basically 38% are likely to be cured, if you will, of depression. For PTSD, the results are more ambiguous. They did a meta-analysis of 55 studies on PTSD remission rates, and they find that you can expect about a 56% remission rate. And so the point there is if somebody's got major depressive disorder or PTSD, they have a basically 1 in 3 to a 1 in 2 chance of actually being cured, if you will, from that impairment. And so kind of closing up here with my recommendations, you know, if it's true that the average Afghan suffers from mental disorder and the average Iraqi suffers from mental disorder and the average person of a weak and failed state suffers from mental disorder, to such a significant portion where it's 1 in 2 of the population, you really have to scratch your head and ask, what are the reasonable chances of achieving stability or, moreover, achieving the U.S. objectives in that country? You know, so I can just kind of borrow from A Princess Bride. Never mess with a Sicilian when death is on the line. You guys remember that? Okay. Actually, that was the second oldest. The oldest is never start a land war in Asia, but that's incorrectly been identified. It should be the idea of do not conduct counterinsurgency anywhere unless you absolutely have to, because the chances are you're going to be doing it in a weak and failed state, and there's not a lot of reason to suspect that that's going to turn out well from the American, from our objectives perspective. The second recommendation is this idea that if we're going to do counterinsurgency, we have to include a psychological estimate in our O plan. And I don't mean this from a benevolent kind way. I mean this from an ass-kicking America wants to achieve its national security objectives way. Every gain we achieve and then leave behind a traumatized, mental disordered population, you can see how that's like a house on sand. It's going to collapse is the idea. So we need to take that into account in our planning factors. And to the extent we can, we need to bring forward mental health capability, just like we do a lot of our other capabilities, to seek to restore the population, not just to be kind, but to achieve U.S. objectives. And then the third and kind of most obvious recommendation is somebody well beyond my skill set needs to investigate this, hopefully from the academic world, the medical world, and confirm or deny my central preposition, which is weak and failed states are beset with mental disorders, and that does not bode well for us achieving U.S. objectives there. Thanks.
Thanks, Carl. Now we're going to shift from over there to really all over the world and radicals here, too, with Randy Blake's presentation.
This already has a feel of a really depressing panel. and I suspect I'm not going to help that feeling anymore, although I do have to say The Princess Bride is the classic. Okay, last September, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and in Inspire magazine had this quote, 10th anniversary. There was a world before 9/11, another one drastically different after 9/11. 9/11 has left a permanent scar on the American psyche and will live long after in the hearts of all Americans, of every American. Yet the only constant is change, and no one issue dominates forever. And my research is focused much less on the post 9/11 decade, but on outline a series of new realities that had already begun to take shape in late 2008 and 2009, well before Osama bin Laden's death, and are dominating the violent jihadist terrorism landscape today. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about three paradigms. The first, and the, with obvious overlap, the first is what's been described as a world on Wi-Fire, which is the fundamental impact of the merging of globalization with the technological revolution underway. Now, to be clear, I'm not talking about the onset of the Internet in the early 1980s or the post-Cold War emergence of globalization as a dominant theme. Or in particular, I'm not simply talking about propaganda videos that have been on the web for years now. I'm talking about developments in the last 3 to 4 years, and they're on the horizon, that have had a big impact on the way we live and the way terrorists do business and on our security. There's nothing subtle about what's unfolding around us. The British technologist Ben Hammersley called it a revolution, easily on par with the Renaissance or the Enlightenment. The scope and scale is enormous. In 2003, less than 1 billion devices connected to the Internet. By 2010, that number was over 12 billion, and we're headed to 25 billion in 2015. What matters most about this is not whether we call it a revolution, but how we use it. We now live online predominantly in what has been called digital silos or filter bubbles, and think about this in your own life, with those who are most like us and reinforce our own views and biases. In this new form of online tribalism, connected networks are rivaling physical hierarchies in speeding up terrorist recruitment and transformation from radicalization to mobilization to action. Overseas travel and communications with organized terrorist groups, which are a key vulnerability, are no longer a prerequisite, meaning that more and more extremist activity is occurring locally. Let me repeat that. More and more extremist activity is occurring locally. American-born and now deceased AQAP senior leader Anwar Awlaki is a good example of this and the best one so far, of redefining this dynamic intersection between the message, the messenger, the new media, and operations. According to a January analysis by the Muslim Public Affairs Council, of 28 plots since Barack Obama was elected president, Awlaki has played an inspirational or an operational role in 18 of them. Online violent jihadist opinion leaders only have to be believable to be effective. And let me give you one example. In 2008, an 18-year-old Fairfax, Virginia resident named Zachary Chesser became interested in Islam and obsessed with extremist online content. By the time of his arrest 2 years later in 2010, he had threatened the creators of South Park sitcom for their portrayal of the Prophet Muhammad, had posted personal Facebook information of some of their supporters, and had tried to travel to Somalia to join al-Shabaab. In those 2 short years, Chesser had been directly involved in three YouTube channels, 2 Twitter accounts, his Facebook blog, his Facebook profile, 1 blog, 6 forums, and 2 websites. His sites had hundreds of hits, which he monitored on a monthly basis. This increased transparency and sharing online is providing expanded operational options for surveillance and for targeting. In August 2009, another fast tracker, Colleen LaRose, better known as Jihad Jane, was on her way from Philadelphia to Europe as part of a terrorist cell that had coalesced online with a plan to kill Lars Vilks, a Swedish cartoonist, for his drawing of the Prophet Muhammad. While there, LaRose joined Vilks' online community and attempted to track his movements on the Internet. But 2009 already seems like a long time ago in the technological revolution that's underway. And that is changing the way we think about privacy and the way terrorists think about surveillance. And just one of what could be many examples today, several companies have developed apps that analyze your Facebook and Twitter networks to see if any friends of friends are nearby. This new generation of apps broadcasts your location at all times to friends and often, in many cases, to people you don't even know. In 2011, Rezwan Ferdus, a 26-year-old Massachusetts man with a bachelor's degree in physics, tried unsuccessfully to put together an attack on the U.S. Capitol and the Pentagon by using remote-controlled unmanned aircraft. The ones he was looking at were about nearly 6 feet long with a wingspan of 4 feet. And we tend to think of drones and military, and certainly in this audience, in terms of predators and reapers, but we need to it's time to think again. How about your own personal surveillance drone, the size of a pizza box or even smaller, that you can operate with your iPhone? One that could be used by the paparazzi to spy on celebrities or by others to spy on cheating spouses or wandering teenagers, with a 40-minute hover period that could prove very effective for terrorists in an updated Colleen LaRose scenario. The FAA projects that 30,000 drones could be in our nation's sky by 2020. It's also remarkable that global jihadists employing the far enemy strategy to defeat the U.S. military politically and economically have not today put themselves near the top of the information warfare cyber operators list. But that may be changing. In June of 2011, Al-Qaeda Corps for the first time went to some length to encourage individuals to conduct cyber attacks in the West. The second key paradigm shift, which is related to the first in this new chapter of global jihad, is the new normal of the increased threat of homegrown violent extremism here in the U.S. A small handful of extremists unmoved by planned U.S. military withdrawals from Iraq and Afghanistan are attempting to fight overseas wars at home. Many came of age in the post-9/11 America and are also dealing with more localized grievances here. The same study that I mentioned earlier noted that 54% of all incidents and plots by Muslim terrorists against the United States since 9/11 have occurred since early 2009. Another researcher noted back in December that of the 18 attacks that have directly targeted the U.S. military forces here in the United States, 14 of those have occurred since 2007. A decade after 9/11, something in the American extremist calculation has changed. And going on assuming that high-probability, low-consequence attacks will continue in an increasingly tech-enabled world is a risky bet. In this new chapter of global jihad, the glide path from radicalization to mobilization to action is changing, and it's unclear whether the end of the wars or the death of celebrity ideologues like Alaki will move us from what since 2009 has become the new normal. Effective strategies that treat the tech revolution like a revolution, active community engagement, local and federal law enforcement efforts, and moving the broader national discussion beyond the 9/11 scar that Inspire referred to are some of the key ways of dealing with the challenges of these two paradigms. The third one, which I'll hit much more briefly, is the issue of changing dynamics overseas that are impacting the threat. The first is the hollowing out of the Al-Qaeda core leadership, which goes way beyond Osama bin Laden. This increased under President Bush and then went on to new heights under our new president in 2009, moving the group closer to operational dismantlement and strategic defeat. It's occurring at the same time that there's an increasingly vertical global jihadist movement operating more like network communities of interest. They're gradually replacing this more center of gravity, hierarchical, focused structure dominated by Al-Qaeda Corps for almost 25 years now. But unlike Al-Qaeda Corps, which is engaged almost all completely in terrorism and survival, the affiliates and allies have a lot more on their plates and are becoming increasingly diverse, and that's key. While dealing with an array of local and regional activities to include terrorism, insurgency, criminal enterprises, humanitarian and government issues. The second is the post-war conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Eric already pointed out the effect there of countries in which if you were born there, or live there, born after 1979, you've seen 10,000 days of war. A generation of extremists, though, raised in that war footing, have been preparing to move from wars to alternatively hot and cold ethnic and sectarian conflicts in which neighboring states are playing an often unhelpful self-interest role. Our withdrawal is robbing the al-Qaeda, the global jihadists, of the currency of a key pillar of their strategy, but also providing openings for them. If you think war is messy, wait till you see what peace looks like. The third is the Arab awakening, which is haltingly moving toward a potentially irreversible shift from subjects to citizens with an uneven pace and trajectory. It represents a challenge to al-Qaeda Corps' message on how to obtain and exercise power. Islamist prominence in governance with a distinctively nationalist pedigree is providing a viable alternative to al-Qaeda's grand caliphate goal and relegating the group to a near-term future as a quasi-oppositionist, troublemaking party in exile. But unique opportunities are also there, and the history of modern global jihad is littered with examples of prison releases producing new terrorist leaders. The developments of factionalism within disaffected Islamists could include the emergence of new extremist groupings, some linking with existing ones to include al-Qaeda. The potential for terrorist acquisition of conventional and non-conventional weapon stocks is alerting. Yemen, Libya, and Syria in particular provide opportunities for affiliates to make gains and establish footholds. So keeping the pressure up on al-Qaeda Corps, treating the affiliates and allies in terms of local and regional issues is a strategy prescription intent on effectively trying to deglobalize the global jihad. This is true whether we're talking about a post-war conflict or the Arab awakening, where negotiations, even while fighting, and new governance coalitions pose a significant challenge to al-Qaeda's increasingly out-of-date my way or the highway vision. Thank you.
Thanks, Randy. And now for our last bit of good news. We've got Lieutenant Colonel Murphy and her presentation on bioterror bedlam.
Thank you. And personally, I think a personal surveillance drone for my soon-to-be teenagers would be a very handy thing to have. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to submit to you this afternoon that the answer to the problem of bioterror bedlam lies in elephants and cheese. And if that made no sense to you, that's a good thing. But hopefully I have your attention. I chose to call this bioterror bedlam, even though those are somewhat, you know, terror and bedlam are somewhat synonymous, not because it is, but because when it comes to discussing the prospect of bioterror, there is absolute bedlam as far as what the analysts think might or should happen. Over the past 20 years, there have been several assessments with a different tagline on the front. Some of them say risk, some of them say threat, some of them say vulnerability. And often those terms are used interchangeably. But they have reached sometimes wildly different conclusions. Everything from, and now I'm paraphrasing here, I'm surprised we haven't seen more of it, to, yeah, it may or may not be a concern in the future. So at the beginning, I'll do something that I loathe to do, which is start with a definition. But while I'm talking about bio threats, to me, threats, I'm going to be using the same way that the Air Force does, which is the RAND construct. Threat is a function of intent and capability. So with that, I'm going to go back to those studies and point out to you that those analysts have reached very different conclusions about the factors involved in threat as well. And some have asserted that it is impossible to know intent, impossible to discern it. Therefore, we should turn to capabilities assessments as a surrogate to get at what is the bioterror threat. Interestingly, this year's Counterproliferation Review Committee's report to Congress concluded that because it is relatively easy to hide an offensive biological program, that we should make a better effort at assessing intent as our surrogate for threat analysis. So we've come full circle, at least on our opinions. This reminds me a little bit of the Indian parable about the six blind men and the elephant, hence elephants. which is, some of you may recall this, six blind men examine an elephant, but each of them examines a different portion of the animal through touch, and of course come to wildly different conclusions about what an elephant looks like and what it is. So none of them by themselves could paint the complete picture. And in fact, what they really needed to do was assemble a composite. And even then, because they were only using really one sense, probably shouldn't have quite the complete picture. But that's the best analogy I could think of. And I would submit to you that, like a living being, the elephant, a bioterror attack is actually a complex system. And a systems approach and a systems analysis really is indicated for getting at that, unraveling that mystery of how likely is it that we might face this. Now, excuse me, those two main pieces, intent and capability, are themselves huge, multifaceted issues. We have about 6 minutes left, so I'm going to dwell mostly on the capability piece, which, in my opinion, is probably the least understood of those. But I will foot stomp a couple things about threat. Excuse me, intent. And that is, when looking at intent or looking at potential for a bioterror attack, what we need to do is examine in the context of what a potential adversary's objectives are. Those objectives will drive the targeting strategy. And then the next question is, what weapon, biologic agent or otherwise, might suit an effective attack on that target? Sometimes we tend to divorce the study of WMD or counterproliferation from counterterror. Absolutely have got to put together that analysis of how beliefs drive behavior, and then what I'm going to talk about here, the capability or the biology piece of that. One more conclusion from that parable of the elephants, and one more thing I need to point out to you about a lot of these assessments that have happened over the past 20 years is they've attempted to take the rare number of past cases of bioterror or biocrime, dissect those, and detect overarching principles from which maybe they can apply to forecast the future. This is a very valid approach. It's absolutely necessary. But if you're going to complete the picture like we would in any good scientific enterprise, you need to use both inductive, which is what this is, and deductive reasoning. Inductive is like this. Use past cases, build upon that to develop a working theory. The yin and yang of that is, once you have a theory, you need some way to test that theory. And so what I'm going to propose to you in the next few minutes is a deductive framework from which to do some thought experiments. An important aside on this, and my other foot stomp, is that in our case, our elephant is growing and changing at the rate of about 400% per year. That's the rate of change in the biologic sciences since 1982. If you believe Rob Carlson, the famed biohacker, that actually outpaces anything in the information technology sector. So very, very rapid change in the very thing we're trying to assess. And that's some of the danger in looking at past cases. Science isn't the same anymore. Okay, so capability. And this is where cheese comes into the equation. When trying to assess a low probability, high consequence event, the aviation safety and medical communities borrow something known as a Swiss cheese model. It's developed by a gentleman named James Reason. And the thought goes something like this, that for those events, there are several layers of safeguards in place. Catastrophic accident will only occur if holes in all of those layers happen to line up and complete a pathway. If you take that visual model and apply it to what is required to develop and deliver a biological agent, the same theory or same principle applies. You have to line up all the holes, and if you're an adversary, rather than trying to prevent them from happening, you're trying to line them up as fast as you can. And so you're going to pick the path of least resistance to the cheese, or the biggest holes in each slice, more than likely. So our layers in this case are working backwards from the target, the pathway we're going to deliver the agent, maybe or maybe not having to stabilize it so we can get it to the target, amplification or how we grow it, and if ultimately how we acquired it in the first place. The pathway tends to be the least understood and the most controversial, so I'll start there. The holes in this layer cheese, there are five of them, five ways to get a poison or a biological agent to the human body. I'm going to generalize this since this is so short a time. Three of those are really viable if your objective is a mass casualty attack. That's an important caveat. If your objective is merely economics or disruption, you don't really have to succeed at getting it into somebody's body. The biggest hole in this layer is actually the ingestion route, food and water poisoning. That is the easiest to pull off. And here I'd like to do a few myth-busting statements. There seems to be a perception that inhalation pathway or the primacy of aerosols is absolutely necessary. Again, not necessarily the case. An interesting corollary to that is that an airborne attack is hard to pull off. And I'll reserve some of this for answers if you are interested, but I think our own USAMRID proved that wrong way back in 1966. I'd also like to suggest to you that from here and forever, we ban the term weaponization with regard to a biological agent. Normally that refers to the stabilization layer of cheese that would be required if you're going to pull off an airborne attack. And if you're going to contaminate a food and water source with a naturally occurring bacteria that you can keep at body temperature till you get it there, like the Rajneeshis did in 1986, you don't have to stabilize very much at all. So the easiest way to get through that layer is just not do it. Finally, amplification is the growing of the agent. In general, bacteria are easier to grow than viruses. And this one you can also completely circumvent if you're able to acquire your agent in sufficient quantity from a failed state or a supplier. And there is some concern with the advent of using Botox for cosmetic procedures so that you might just be able to go buy that off the black market somewhere. Okay, finally, acquisition. There is an excellent NDU paper that lists the five acquisition pathways for biologic. The first is to harvest it from nature. The second is to steal it or acquire it from a research center. The third is buy it from a culture collection. The fourth is to modify one pathogen into another one. And there are examples of all four of these in past cases. The fifth, thankfully, we have not seen yet, which is to completely chemically synthesize a virus. But a few years ago, Wimmer et al. Proved that you can do this without even a natural template when they synthesize the poliovirus. Personally, I'm going to add a couple more. Sixth, get it from a failed government program. And touching on current events, Egypt, Libya, Syria were all thought to have at least completed some R&D work into offensive biologics. Where might that expertise and material end up? And on that note, we're still concerned about talent and material from the former Soviet Union, Iraq, and to a certain extent, South Africa. The other is, depending on your definition of terror or terrorism, if you are state-sponsored or a special ops agent for a state, then you probably have no problem at all acquiring one of these weapons. I'll conclude by saying, of course, the fastest way to line up the holes in the cheese is if you have an expert who can do it for you. And it's pretty well documented that Al-Qaeda recognized this and sought to do it. And which has led several very prominent biologists and USAMRID alumni to say we are less concerned about terrorists becoming biologists than biologists becoming terrorists. And with the transition of Al-Qaeda to recruiting and radicalizing and local terrorism, that is becoming a greater and greater risk. So in this flying 10 minutes or so that we've had, hopefully you've concluded, like I did, that to get at the picture of the elephant, you absolutely have to use an interdisciplinary approach, a very complex system. And as far as capability is concerned, you're hoping we race through the cheese faster than the bad guys. Thanks very much.
Thanks. I think I'm now going to retreat to my secure, hermetically sealed bubble. I want to start opening up for questions, but I'll take a moderator's prerogative and ask the first one, and ask that of Colonel Gopner. So you talked about, you know, a major chunk, maybe half of Afghanistan being traumatized, PTSD, depression, both. And you talked about, well, you know, we should take that into account the next time we decide to stage a large-scale counterinsurgency. But I'd like to ask about the current large-scale operation we're in. And there's a lot of debate right now about whether we should be pulling out of there sooner or later. So what does your sort of psychological look at Afghanistan tell you about how we should proceed in the next, you know, 12, 24 months and beyond? Start with the easy questions.
Yeah, I was going to try and say something funny, and then I realized it's probably the last thing I should do when we're talking about Afghanistan. I'm a huge believer, and I don't mean this in a jingoistic way, but I'm a huge believer that whatever counterinsurgency we're fighting, to the extent that Americans are 24/7 with the host nation, exponentially increases our chances of success. There's behaviors that each of us have grown up with that we can't identify, but they end up being best practices for how a stable, functioning society does things. And we probably can't enumerate them, but they come out. We saw a lot of evidence during our time in Zabul, just funny things. You know, we'd come around the corner and the police checkpoint would be 100 yards up the road, and they'd be doing like their equivalent of the Department of Transportation, you know. One dude had a shovel and six dudes were just kind of sitting there staring at it. And then as soon as they saw the Americans, they'd get right back to business doing their checkpoint type of stuff. We'd see that with the day laborers that were being hired through the government, through ISAF funding. Anytime an American presence came around, productivity increased and good behaviors seemed to follow. And I understand that the idea of us being 24/7 with our Afghan brothers is certainly under criticism right now because of all the shootings from Afghan security forces back onto ISAF. But that really is the number one ingredient.
And just to put you on the spot, so does that mean those ISAF forces should come home sooner, later, or is that the wrong question to ask?
Yeah, I've become deeply ambivalent. I'm a huge believer that we can win everything. There's absolutely no doubt. The people who say there's not a military solution, I think are that's a foolish thing to say. Everybody has a breaking point, and so the military always can help you find your breaking point, and you will soon comply thereafter. But that's obviously not the way we're going to fight this. I got that part. But I'm deeply ambivalent. I think where I sit right now is I don't think it's going to get any better. I keep hearing gains are being made, but they're reversible and they're fragile. I think I've heard that, you know, for the last 4 years or so. So I'm very comfortable with the president's, you know, glide slope to 2014 where we go into an advisory role only.
With that, I'm going to open it up for questions. Just wait for the microphone, and please make it a question, not a declaration. So have a question mark at the end of your statement. You'll start here with the blue shirt.
Hi, Brad Penniston with Armed Forces Journal. Question for you, Mr. Gopner. I'm struck by this new lens of looking at counterinsurgency doctrine and two possible responses. One is, holy cow, we need to rethink everything. And the other one is, well, we learned everything we know about counterinsurgency doctrine in such places, so no big deal. Either one of those correct?
Can you just sort of rephrase that question, go through it one more time for
me? Yes, I'm sorry. if everything we know about counterinsurgency was learned in a place where most of the population is traumatized, as you describe, do we need to change the way we do anything, or should we just be more reluctant to do it?
I think the second is the big takeaway, which is be much more reluctant to do it. And I'm not trying to necessarily cast stones, but I think you've heard some really funny things from high leaders over the last 10 or 12 years about these things. I think we heard democracy was messy. That's how we approached the Iraq, civil war. General, I can't remember if it was Shinseki or who it was, but got marginalized, for saying we're going to need 350,000 basically constables to pacify Iraq, and that was considered a ridiculous comment. I think it's been borne out more or less. So don't do it. And if you're going to do it, you better bring some mental health capability, or we better rethink two different things. One is how soon we release sovereignty back to that nation. With Afghanistan, we gave sovereignty back to the nation very quickly, and I think we did it way too fast. Joint Doctrine talks about the fact that if a government's still weak and failed, it may not be the right time to give them, their own sort of power back, if you will. And I think we may have erred in that. And then the other part is we need to be careful how I say this. We may need to rethink how we look at the use of force in conducting operations, counterinsurgency operations. We have taken a very pacific view on the use of force in COIN, and that may we may, years from now, want to look back and say, you know what, military, by definition, war is kind of a disgusting thing. So when we go to war, it may have to be a little more disgusting than we've tried to make it.
Okay, just to the right. Am I right?
Thank you very much. My name is Samira Daniels, and this is a question for Crystal. I was trying to visualize, map what you were saying. And I think the weakness in so many of the analysis is, you can get the right facts and you can, but do you have the right story? And I'm wondering to what extent you think different institutions get the right story, because there are only a couple of narratives that are sort of, gain currency. And I'm wondering if, you think it will be possible to sort of expand these perspectives. That is, bottom line, I don't think you can get to where, good analysis unless you really get, good history. And I'm wondering what you think of that, my hypothesis.
I guess first, let me make sure I clearly understand your hypothesis, which is,
And cheese is one dimensional. That is, mm-hmm. if you look at mm-hmm. it, and I see the holes and stuff, mm-hmm. and I think that, if you're going to deal with complexity, you have to mm-hmm. get the the complexity that and mm-hmm. find the right solution and problem, and I'm just wondering, how that can occur in institutions. It's an organizational issue, I think, that I'm asking you more than anything else to get at this issue of complexity.
Okay. Well, first, again, hopefully I clarified that I was only talking a very small piece, which is how to get at the capability piece. The intent piece I deliberately glossed over, largely because I'm sitting with two other gentlemen who are talking, how terrorists might be thinking and what they're doing. absolutely. I think our current structure is a real challenge. Again, we, at least in DOD, tend to separate counterproliferation from counterterror. And there is a seam there. We definitely collaborate. We definitely understand we need to inform each other. But as busy, especially as the counterterror community is, sometimes that's more challenging than we'd like it to be. But absolutely, the cheese is just one piece. To get at intent really takes several disciplines, folks who are smart about, again, all the factors of the ideology of the potential actor. So in the case of Al-Qaeda, somebody who understands the particular ideological background, that particular sect of Islam, somebody who understands the culture, the study of how they have adapted and franchised themselves since then, and then again to predict what is it they want to do and the context of will they select a biological or not is wrapped up in that. Does it suit their ends? There's a really good book by a gentleman named Adam Dolnick. They got at Understanding Terrorist Innovation, and he gets at who might innovate or be driven to use a weapon of mass destruction and why might they make those choices. Some of them get at if you are becoming desperate to reestablish your credibility or your aura of omnipotence, it might become more attractive to you. Might. But you definitely then need someone like Dr. Post, who understands behavior and psychology, that might help unravel that piece. So absolutely it requires a lot of folks who have an interdisciplinary approach. I think some institutions in academia are very well set up to do that. There are some folks at the national labs. Livermore is a good example of that, that can do some of those. And some folks in our IC that have been organized to look at that a little bit more. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Let's go. Right in the middle there.
Thanks, Captain Cindy Table. I'm from the Navy staff, and this is addressed to Colonel Gepner. So you argue that counterinsurgency is generally not a good approach for the many reasons you've cited. But what do you see as the alternative, then, in a situation with a weak and failed state, an ineffective government, and a high percentage of population with PTSD and or major depressive disorder, which is a circumstance that we seem to think we will be finding ourselves dealing with in the near and long term?
I don't know if this is going to be at all satisfactory. I have two thoughts. You know, one, I think historically we have dramatically underestimated the costs of counterinsurgency. We've done ourselves a disservice to call them small wars. And so I think that's part of it. I think the other part, and I want to be careful because I'm not trying to advocate a foreign policy that's unkind to people, but this idea of being the globe's policeman, this idea of we're going to take care of every weak and failed state from a benevolence perspective, we may want to do that through NGOs, through churches, synagogues, that type of thing. That's great. As a national security priority, I don't buy into that. Then there's a segment that says, okay, don't do it out of benevolence. Just do it because that's where the terrorists are going to go. And my response to that is we're always going to have weak and failed states. We always have. We always will. The management of that is not to go in and restore a weak and failed state. The management is probably some combination of regional pressure and some degree of counterterrorism is my guess. But we're not going to do away from it. You know, remember like we declared war on poverty? I think one of our presidents did that. It's a great ambition, but you're never going to get there. So that's my thoughts on that.
Okay, in the back.
Ken Dillon, former State Department intelligence analyst. On the question of biodefense or bioterrorism, there are some very good reasons to think that the FBI got the wrong man in the anthrax mailings case. I wonder what you think of that and what you think should be done about that.
Oh, I'll take this one. Fine. Right, there are some reasons, and there are some reasons to think that they got the right guy in the 2001 anthrax attacks. You know, my guess after studying the anthrax attacks as closely as any reporter, I think, is, you know, if I had to bet $10, I'd say the guy they were after at the end was probably the guy that did it. If I was a member of a jury, I'd probably have to vote not guilty. And, you know, I don't know that there's evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. But I do think that there's a larger question, which actually I was going to pose to you, which is, you know, by building out all these biodefense labs and by spreading around, you know, potentially lethal stuff all over the country and by training thousands of people how to deal with it, if the real concern is biologists who become terrorists, haven't we trained a huge cadre of biologists to pull off such an attack in the name of preventing one?
The answer is absolutely, and that's not an answer I would like to give. Before I elaborate, though, I want to elaborate on Noah's answer or why I pointed to him. If you are not familiar with Wired magazine, Noah wrote a really great piece on the Amerithrax attacks in Wired, I think, which has now been a year and a half or so. But it was a really great analysis and all the forensics that went into that. And by the way, one of the authors I read pointed out that the technology to do that, those forensics didn't exist at the time of the attack, to go back to how fast the science has changed. As far as training our potential adversaries, absolutely, we did. Al-Qaeda's front man for their anthrax program graduated from, I think, one of the Cal State schools. It's absolutely a problem, and it overlaps with another strategic problem, unfortunately, that we have, which is, I think, America, the United States, lagging a little bit in science, technology, engineering, and math. Where I am currently working, 80% of the postdoc appointees at the laboratory are not United States citizens. A lot of the research that is going on there is in the biologic sciences and in physics. But that's a tough problem, and what I'd offer to you is there absolutely needs to be a better connection between the defense and security sector and academia. I think there right now there's a pretty large gap there. All of this, of course, is my opinion, my personal opinion, not that of the service or DOD. But I'd also offer to you that the New York Police Department has a really innovative program called Project Shield, where they partner with businesses downtown to try to prevent terrorism and harden them as targets. And I'd say there needs to be a Project Shield between defense and security and the academic world when it gets to biologics and getting at ethics and codes of behavior and those types of things, how to prevent the human piece of that.
Okay, we've got time for one last question.
Peter Humphrey, I'm an Intel analyst. I think we might have to embrace profound, profound political incorrectness and not allow Muslims to be working in those laboratories. Colonel Goepner, I'm wondering if you send some murderers to psychiatric hospitals, you send most of them to prison. You really don't care as long as they're neutralized. As we meet these situations out in the field, I really don't care whether the guy's motivated by his craziness, his ideology, his view of the afterlife, his economic situation. I don't care. I want him neutralized. So why criticize COIN? That's just a method of neutralization of bad people, whether they're bad for psychological reasons or moral failings or whatnot. It's immaterial.
I wasn't taking the vantage point of neutralizing or the bad guys. I was taking the vantage point of the good guys. This is the government we're working with. I mean, what would you expect from your government if one in two had major depression or PTSD? My assumption is you wouldn't expect a whole lot, and that's essentially my argument, is that's what you have in the Afghan security force and the Afghan government. And then, moreover, that's what you have with the Afghan population that's in the midst of this tug-of-war, that the government's trying to get their allegiance, you know, separate them from the insurgent, come over to the government side. And all of them are beset with mental disorder. So the idea that Afghanistan is going to emerge with a degree of stability in the next decade, I don't understand how that's a feasible suggestion. It has nothing to do with the bad guys. Those guys, I'm all about marginalize however you want to.
Okay, let's give a round of applause for our panelists.